Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Lindsay Kashgarian, Program Director of the National Priorities Project, who assesses the two-year federal budget deal recently passed by Congress, and how the allocation of these funds impacts vital non-military government programs. Dima Khalidi, founder and director of Palestine Legal, who discusses the importance of a federal judge's ruling that blocked enforcement of a Kansas law that punishes people who boycott Israel. And the Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, who talks about the campaign's goals and planned actions to challenge the evils of systemic racism, poverty, and the nation's distorted morality. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Associated Press reports five mass graves in Myanmar have been identified by Rohingya Muslim refugees who fled to Bangladesh. The mass graves are located in the village of Gudarpin, where army soldiers last summer shot and killed Rohingya teenagers. The Myanmar government has denied any knowledge of the mass graves, but did report that a grave existed in another town where terrorists had been killed. The AP reports that Myanmar's army has engaged in the systematic slaughter of Muslim minority Rohingya civilians with support from Buddhist villagers. Relatives say nearly 400 people were killed during the attack in late August. The violence is another example of what appears to be the genocidal mass murder of the minority Rohingya in Myanmar's embattled Rakhine state. Survivors say Myanmar soldiers had come prepared to commit atrocities. Along with standard military equipment, soldiers carried shovels to dig pits and acid to burn the faces of those killed, so victims could not be identified. Yang He Lee, the UN Special Rapporteur on the human rights situation in Myanmar, said that recent reports of attacks against minority Rohingya civilians, including mass murder, arbitrary arrests, torture, and enforced disappearances, are acts that have been alleged against the military and security forces for generations. She reports that other ethnic groups, including the Kachin, Karen, Kareni, and Shan, have all suffered similar horrific human rights violations at the hands of Myanmar's armed forces over several decades. In a new draft report, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security called on law enforcement agencies to continuously vet Sunni Muslim immigrants entering the U.S. who are deemed to have at-risk demographic profiles. The draft report, obtained by Foreign Policy magazine, looked at 25 U.S.-based terrorist incidents from 2001 to 2017, concluding there would be great value for the United States government in dedicating resources to continuously evaluate persons of interest, and suggesting that immigrants to the U.S. be tracked on a long-term basis. If the draft report is fully implemented, it would represent a vast expansion of the Trump administration's policies targeting many Muslim immigrants, extending vetting from those attempting to enter the United States to those already legally in the country, including permanent residents. The report came to light a month after another controversial report by Homeland Security and the Justice Department was released, which claims that 3 of every 4 individuals convicted of international terrorism or terrorism-related offenses were immigrants. Critics claim the study had serious methodological flaws because it cherry-picked the data to justify the Trump administration's restrictive immigration policies. A Homeland Security official who reviewed the draft report concluded it would push policymakers toward unfair and discriminatory surveillance of specific ethnic groups. Other observers fear that the report could lead Homeland Security to ignore other homegrown national security threats from far-right extremists and violent white supremacists. School children in urban communities are at risk from exposure to air toxins causing illnesses linked to multiple brain-related disorders. The study, which found that Black, Latino, and low-income students were the most likely to be exposed to harmful toxins, was based on research examining environmental conditions at 90,000 public schools across America. A A team of researchers led by Sarah Grineski of the University of Utah analyzed health risks at schools exposed to a dozen neurotoxins, including lead, mercury, and cyanide. The five most polluted school communities included New York City, Chicago, Jersey City, and Camden, New Jersey. Many cash-strapped school districts build public schools on the most inexpensive land available, often located near busy roads, factories, and contaminated brownfield pollution sites. The study used data from the Federal Census and the Environmental Protection Agency, which found that pre-kindergarten students are often at more risk for air pollution than teenagers. According to the Guardian newspaper, more than a quarter of all Black students attend schools with the worst air pollution. In contrast, the majority of white students, who make up over half of the students in the study, attend schools with much lower rates of toxic pollution exposure. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
Despite Republican Party control of the U.S. Senate, the House of Representatives, and the White House, a divided GOP needed the votes of minority Democrats to pass a two-year budget agreement. Although many Democrats had wanted to use their leverage to pass legislation to prevent the deportation of more than 700,000 DACA recipients, undocumented children who were brought to the U.S. by their parents, after a five-and-a-half-hour government shutdown, enough Democrats voted for the bill, and President Trump signed the budget into law on February 9th. The approved budget spends $500 billion more than current law allows by suspending a 2011 law pushed by Freedom Caucus conservatives that set hard caps on discretionary spending and included an automatic trigger known as sequester cuts if Congress attempted to bypass those spending caps. The budget deal for 2018 spends $700 billion for the military and $591 billion for non-military programs. Overall, 54% of the federal discretionary budget is now spent on the military and nuclear weapons. President Trump's recently announced 2019 budget, which is not likely to be passed by Congress, calls for a 14.1% increase in military spending, while making deep cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, education, food stamps, transportation, and other essential government services. Your reporter spoke with Lindsay Kashgarian, program director of the National Priorities Project, who assesses the two-year federal budget deal passed by Congress and how the allocation of these federal funds impacts vital non-military programs.
The budget that Congress passed last week was the budget for fiscal year 2018, which actually started on October 1st of last year, so it took them several months to get the job done. And a lot of the national attention about why the budget was such a difficult process in Congress and what the disagreements were focused on the need for a humanitarian solution for the Dreamers, you know, these people who were brought to the United States as immigrants, as young children, and have since made their lives here. But what didn't get quite as much attention was the differences between spending in the budget for the Pentagon, military, and nuclear weapons versus spending for everything else that's funded by the discretionary budget. And that's the part of the budget. It's over $1 trillion, and that's what Congress decides each year when they go through this budget process. And essentially, the question was how much they would fund the Pentagon and military versus how much they would fund everything else. Now, Democrats generally were trying to negotiate for more spending for things like education and health and the State Department, while they were also willing to accept higher spending on the Pentagon. Many Republicans wanted higher spending on the Pentagon without raising spending on those domestic things, although some of them wanted to cut both. And the deal they came to was to raise spending a little bit for each. So they gave $80 billion above what were the previous spending limits to the Pentagon, and they gave $60 billion above the previous limits to everything else. And in Washington, D.C. politics, this is what people refer to as parity of spending between the Pentagon and between everything else. But of course, $80 billion doesn't equal $60 billion. So they're not equal in that sense. And it's also as if you took half of your inheritance and gave it to one child, and then took the other half and gave it to your four other children and called it equal. So there are a couple of reasons why parity is really a bad name for this.
Now, Lindsay, in terms of the distribution of tax dollars towards military and non-military spending, what does it say about the nation's priorities at the moment in terms of the dollars going to fund new weapons systems, other projects that the Pentagon has in mind, new fighter jets and all the rest, versus what really needs to be addressed in the country in terms of social programs, especially considering the growing gap between the rich and poor in this country?
Well, in almost any given year, more than half of our discretionary budget, that pot that Congress decided last week, goes to the Pentagon and military. And they maintained that ratio in this budget deal. 54% of the funds they allocated will go to the Pentagon and nuclear weapons, while the remaining 46% will go to everything else. So clearly, the priority that Congress places is that military solutions trump, pardon the expression, everything else. The budget the president released, which was his budget request for 2019, and does come into direct conflict with the budget limits that Congress set for 2019. So it's unlikely that this budget proposal will become a reality, but that's always the case with presidential budget requests. But the budget request we saw shows clearly what the president's priorities are and where he wants to see our government headed. And what we saw there was that he maintained Pentagon spending of over $700 billion a year, which is about a 10% increase over recent spending levels that we've had for the Pentagon. And it's also a spending level that keeps us in the range of spending more than the next 8 to 10 countries in the world combined. We spend more than 3 times as much as China. We spend 9 times as much as Russia on our military. So our military spending is already sky high, and now it's growing.
What kind of policies do the minority Democrats, who certainly don't have much control in the House or the Senate right now, what do they bring to the table in terms of their views on the levels of military spending that should be approved?
It's a wild mix. Last week, when the budget deal was passing Congress, you had Senator Chuck Schumer, who is the Senate leader of the Democrats, saying that he supported both more military spending and spending for the middle class. So you have everything from that to Democrats like Pramila Jayapal or Adam Smith in the House of Representatives who question our military spending and really recognize that there is such a thing as too much. And one of the things that I think that people who across the political spectrum, again, this is not limited to Democrats, you know, there are definitely fiscal hawk Republicans who are very interested in seeing us call back some of the wasteful Pentagon spending that's out there. We need to make it more understood that more Pentagon spending does not equal more safety.
That was Lindsay Kashgarian, Program Director of the National Priorities Project. Find links to more analysis of military and non-military spending in the U.S. federal budget by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A federal judge in Kansas recently ruled that a state law making it illegal to support the Palestinian Civil Society call for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS, against Israel for its illegal occupation of the West Bank was unconstitutional. Kansas is one of 24 states with anti-BDS laws on the books. The state laws take various forms, including prohibiting individuals who support BDS from being awarded state contracts and/or prohibiting states from investing in companies that boycott Israel. The BDS movement calls for dismantling the wall that cuts through Palestinian land, guaranteeing the right of Palestinians to return to their homes inside Israel, and assuring that equal rights are accorded to all Palestinian citizens of Israel. Federal legislation known as the Israel Anti-Boycott Act has been introduced in Congress with bipartisan support and is a top legislative priority this year for AIPAC, the most powerful and most well-funded pro-Israel lobbying group in the U.S. The proposed bill includes harsh criminal sanctions for U.S. persons who comply with or support boycotts of Israel in response to calls by the United Nations, the European Union, or other international governmental organizations. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Dima Khalidi, founder and director of Palestine Legal. The group, based in Chicago and founded in 2012, works to protect the constitutional rights of those advocating for Palestinian freedom. Here, Khalidi explains the federal judge's ruling, upholding a U.S. citizen's right to engage in protest and boycotts targeting Israel's illegal occupation, and its significance.
The ACLU brought the lawsuit on behalf of a Mennonite school teacher who was involved in a teacher training program and had to contract with the state to be paid by the state for training other teachers. And because of Kansas's their new anti-boycott law, which prohibits individuals, contractors with the state from boycotting Israel, she was required to sign a certification that she didn't boycott Israel in order to be involved with this teacher training program. And because her church and she herself decided to boycott certain Israeli companies and other companies that are complicit in Israel's occupation, she refused to sign the certification. And she is not able to be involved in this teacher training program as a result. So it's clear in this case that there's a political litmus test being applied for those that want to contract with the state. And that is completely constitutionally unacceptable. The math teacher tried to get a preliminary injunction to stop the state from enforcing this law while the litigation proceeds. And the judge granted that preliminary injunction. So the state is now blocked from enforcing this law as long as this lawsuit is ongoing. So the decision was really important in making very clear that this law appears unconstitutional as a violation of First Amendment rights. The judge confirmed that boycotts for Palestinian rights are the same as the boycotts that precipitated the Supreme Court case, NAACP v. Claiborne, in 1982. And those were boycotts against white businesses in the South protesting segregation and racism during the civil rights era. This decision is a really important precedent for other challenges that will surely come up against other anti-boycott laws and to prevent other anti-boycott laws from being enacted, hopefully, when legislators see that a judge has ruled this way. The ACLU has also brought a lawsuit against a very similar law in Arizona, and that ruling is pending as well.
Dima Khalidi, Israel itself has just created a blacklist of 20 international organizations, including Code Pink and Jewish Voice for Peace, that can no longer enter Israel and therefore can't get into the West Bank due to their support for BDS. What impact do you think this will have on efforts to squelch support for BDS?
Yes, this is clearly one of the many strategies that Israel is using to intimidate, to bully people who are speaking out for Palestinian rights, and they're trying to send a message that if you take this kind of position, not only will you not be allowed into this country, whatever your background is, but you will also be pursued in other ways. And as I said, Palestine Legal, my organization, has been documenting for 5 years the array of ways that Israel and Israel advocacy groups in the U.S. are targeting activists and regular people who are speaking out publicly for Palestinian rights. And the ways range from lawsuits to this legislative strategy to defamation campaigns against individuals. They're very targeted against individual students, professors, other activists, profiles of people on the internet, on anonymous websites that claim they are pro-terrorist or anti-Semitic for their views. We're seeing universities being pressured very hard by Israel advocacy groups to punish student activists who are protesting, who are bringing divestment resolutions. The list goes on. And all of these methods of suppression are aimed at silencing people who believe in Palestinian human rights, who want to see accountability for Israel's decades of subjugation of Palestinians, dispossession of Palestinians.
That was Dima Khalidi, founder and director of Palestine Legal. Learn more about Palestine Legal and the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Religious leaders, joined by members of civil rights groups, labor unions, and fast food workers, gathered in Washington, D.C., and more than two dozen states across the U.S. on February 5th to launch the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. The campaign, co-chaired by Moral Monday's founder, Reverend William Barber, and Reverend Liz Theo Harris, say their mission is to continue the work of the original Poor People's Campaign, organized by Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in the late 1960s. The coalition of groups engaged in the campaign kicked off 40 days of what they described as moral action to highlight the human impact of policies which promote systemic racism, poverty, the war economy, and environmental devastation. On February 12th, the Poor People's Campaign joined fast food and other low-paid workers in Los Angeles, Detroit, Memphis, in other cities across the U.S., to rally support for a $15 per hour minimum wage and the right to unionize. In Memphis, hundreds of Fight for 15 activists commemorated the 50th anniversary of the city's 1968 sanitation workers' strike, supported by Reverend King and the civil rights movement at the time. Your reporter spoke with Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, co-director of the Cairo Center, who, as Poor People's Campaign co-chair, was in Memphis to lead the protests. Here, Reverend Theo Harris talks about the campaign's goals and planned actions to challenge the evils of racism, poverty, and the nation's distorted morality.
So for many years, grassroots organizations across the United States have been saying that we need to kind of come together and build a Poor People's Campaign for today. We do draw lessons on theory and theology from Dr. King and from the Poor People's Campaign of 1967 and 68. You know, in that campaign, the last campaign of Dr. King's life, he was connecting the kind of what he called the evils, the tripartite evils of systemic racism, of militarism, and of economic exploitation, and said that poor and dispossessed people of all races and all geographies needed to be brought together into a united and organized force in order to kind of wake up the nation and unsettle a bunch of what was going on at the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we see today, 50 years later, there's a 60% increase in poverty since there was in 1968. The military budget is even more of a huge section of our budget than it was, you know, 50 years ago. And systemic racism is still alive and well. And so we're kind of building a new Poor People's Campaign, reigniting the campaign that Dr. King and others were leading 50 years ago, and saying that it's time for a kind of deep moral revival in our nation. We need to, you know, shake things up, and we need a breakthrough to be able to prioritize what's really needed in, on the key issues of our day, and see that the real moral issues of our time are things like health care and living wages and education for our kids and voting rights and an end to the kind of pollution and ecological devastation that are taking place. And so poor people and clergy and activists and others are coming together and calling for this campaign and pledging to be a part of 40 days of moral direct action and nonviolent civil disobedience in this coming spring.
And Reverend Theo Harris, could you lay out some of the goals that you're working on within the Poor People's Campaign? What are some of the policy demands that you'd like to communicate to Congress and the White House?
Yeah, so we are calling for 40 days of of moral direct action focus on a moral agenda that is still in the works. Right now, the goals of the campaign are really twofold. One is to shift the moral narrative that is happening and out there in our nation right now. You know, when we looked at the 2016 presidential election, there were 26 presidential debates in the primary and in the general election. And in those 26 debates, not one of them focused on problems of living wages or universal health care, of poverty and voting rights, of ecological devastation and the problems of the war economy. And so to be able to have gotten through such an expensive and such a interesting 2016 presidential debates and not have the issues that are affecting the majority of people in this country the majority of the time means that we need to do something to kind of shift the narrative and make it impossible that our elected officials and candidates can talk about what they're going to do and not actually speak to poverty and racism and the issues that are plaguing our nation today. And
Reverend Theo Harris, can you tell us a bit about some of the dates coming up for actions that the Poor People's Campaign has planned around the country?
Great. So from March 1st through 5th, many of folks with the Poor People's Campaign and National Call for Moral Revival will be in Selma, Alabama. It's the 53rd anniversary of Bloody Sunday, and we'll be there making the connection between poverty and economic injustice and voting rights. Around April 4th, which is the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination, the Poor People's Campaign and National Call for Moral Revival will be in Memphis again with the National Civil Rights Museum and with others that are looking to the legacy of Dr. King 50 years after his assassination. Then on June 23rd, we'll be doing a mass mobilization in Washington, D.C., where we're talking about the next steps in the campaign and what people are called to do to continue to build power and organization amongst those that are impacted by the injustices that are in our world today. And so this spring, we're hoping that folks all across the country in state houses will take place in these 40 days, this 6 weeks of organizing and education and moral direct action.
That was Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, co-director of the Cairo Center and co-chair, along with Reverend William Barber, of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. Learn more about the campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, WTND in Macomb, Georgia, KRFY in Sandpoint, Idaho, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Nikita. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.